Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. In their recent report, Taliban claims to have in control of vast regions in Afghanistan. Bulk of those territories located in northern Afghanistan, the areas bordering Central Asian countries of Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. We obviously take the claim with grain and salt, but nevertheless, the security situation in northern Afghanistan continue to deteriorate. Today, the presence of the Taliban are reported in every corner in northern Afghanistan, and several districts are under their full control. On the other hand, the authorities on the other side of the border are increasingly worried and appears to be taking desperate measures. U.S. General has recently accused Russia of supplying to the Taliban. Some Afghan leaders say similar activities are taking place on the Afghan-Turkmen and Afghan-Tajik borders. On this episode of Majlis, we plan to revisit the region to assess its security situation, changing dynamics, and what does it say to Central Asia, and what are they doing about this? To discuss the subject, I have Bill Rogio, editor of Long War Journal and veteran of Afghan War. Amin Mudakik, a journalist originally from northern Afghanistan, currently heads the RFRL's Pakistan service called Radio Mashal. Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlaq Awazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Bloc. Gentlemen, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you with this. Let's start with you, Bill. I was reading your report on Taliban's recent claims. It seems you found the content of their report quite realistic. Tell us more, please.
Let me start with, I've been trying to track this for several years now, and we've been basing it on press reporting, so information from government reports and Taliban claims. So I plotted a map, and it was very incomplete, but I think it was pretty accurate as far as the security situation in areas that we could see. I always said there was a lot that we couldn't tell from the information. So lo and behold, on late March, the Taliban issued their own version. With the reason I find it credible, not because it matches with the information that I currently have, but there is large areas of Afghanistan where they're saying, look, we don't control any territory. Some of these areas include in the Taliban heartland, in where the Taliban grew from, in places like Panjwe and Zari and Kandahar. So, you know, that to me tells me that the Taliban aren't exaggerating. They only claim they control 34 of the more than 400 districts in Afghanistan. Based on my rating, the Taliban's, you know, they gave a percentage of control. I considered about anywhere from 40 to 99%. Of control, they're either contested or hotly contested. Mm. This really largely matches with the security situation that we're seeing today. The fact that the Taliban are again, I can't emphasize this enough, that they're saying, look, there's areas where we're only conducting insurgent or guerrilla, quote unquote, guerrilla operations. And there's areas that they say the enemy, being the Afghan government, has full control of these areas. I don't think this is made up. And when we look at the security situation, Helmand has been probably the easiest province to track. Hmm. The Taliban's data largely matches, if not fully matches, with my monitoring of Helmand province. So again, I have to give them, in some sense, this could be by Taliban standards because they're prone to exaggerating claims. Mm-hmm. I think this is somewhat of a conservative estimate by the Taliban. Mm-hmm. I think it's a realistic picture of what is going on in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it should be very worrying to the Afghan government, to the U.S. military, to U.S. government and NATO. You have nearly the entire south controlled or contested by the Taliban, and almost the entire east controlled or contested by the Taliban, with small pockets of government control.
Mm. Let me put this in context. The report under discussion talks about 34 districts of Afghanistan being under the full Taliban control, including their district centers. That's important. The appear to contest another 167 districts and claims of having significant presence in 52 additional districts. Remember, Afghanistan has around 400 districts in total. So when you put these numbers together, I guess they are questioning the authority of the Afghan administration in nearly half of the country. One might also question that since when we began taking the Taliban's claim serious. So this is your turn, Amin, to talk on this. So tell us, please, what is your realistic assessment of the situation and your take on these territorial claims by the Taliban?
Well, if control means to hold it as well, then the Taliban's claims are really exaggerated. But if control means the presence, yes, Taliban have presence in almost 50% of the country, in even 60% in the east, in south. But the Taliban presence is in a way that they are there as long as there is no Afghan in coalition or ISAF or NATO forces there. So in their absence, Afghanistan is a large country. It's mountainous country. It is made of 34,000 or up to 40,000 villages. So it is impossible virtually for Afghan government in the NATO forces to be present in each village. By that definitions, yes, the Taliban are there. And even that kind of presence is expanding. Because if you go to the northern Afghanistan, a year ago, it was most part of the north was peaceful. Like you could travel very peacefully and comfortably on the Kabul-Mazar highway. But now, as soon as you cross the northern Salang, in Baghlan, in starting from Baghlan, Dushi, and all the highways, dangerous up to the Mazar-e-Sharif. So it means that in that kind of presence of Taliban are increasing. I think to me the best way to put it is the Taliban presence, not control.
Right.
Control means that you have to capture an area and hold it. By that definition, they don't have any district, you know. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are some districts which government does not have any presence there. That could be something like about 15 districts.
Mm-hmm. They claim 34 districts of Afghanistan being under their full control, including their district centers. So the rest, the number that I mentioned, either they are contested or just Taliban is partially present in those districts. So, Bruce, let's bring it closer to home. You just had a story on security map of Afghan Central Asia border. So tell us, please, what has changed since we last visited the region on Majlis?
Well, there's, you know, throughout the winter, and winter is usually a lull, of course, you know, pretty much in any theater of conflict, especially in a place like Afghanistan, where you end up with harsh winter, snow, things like that. But there really wasn't that much of a lull in fighting. In fact, it seemed to just at least keep the same intensity that it had going through the summer and coming into the autumn, which I found alarming. There really was no break in a lot of the, you know, Faryab had a lot of problems and Jozjan had a lot of problems. Kunduz, of course, had many problems too, and even Badakhshan way in the east, which seems to be, even the Taliban didn't say that they had much activity going on in Badakhshan, but local officials in Badakhshan, you know, claim that War Doj district, for instance, was needed to be cleared of insurgents, and they were launching an operation to do that. So I thought that was, well, that was the most alarming thing to me, was just to see that for the first year and of the last few years, and there has been fighting there, you know, across the north since 2013, 2014, but this time it really, there wasn't much of a halt in the activity for the most part. It just kept going and going right through. And certainly, and I thought another part that was another change in the situation just recently is that at least on the Afghan side of the border, they're starting to talk more about the Central Asians having some kind of role in what's going on over there. You know, there was the claim a couple months ago that Taliban fighters were able to cross into Tajikistan and possibly get medical treatment or have their vehicles repaired or something, tanks even possibly repaired in Tajikistan. And of course, the Tajik government denied that was true. Yeah. And then Ismail Khan, who's been well known in Afghanistan for decades now, just at the start of this month, I believe, said that Turkmenistan was providing arms to the Taliban too. So even if the Central Asian governments, of course, Turkmenistan denied that too, and even though they're denying it, we never heard this kind of talk on the Afghan side of the border before, that possibly their northern neighbors were participating and somehow or another aiding the enemy.
Mm. We will get back to that aspect. Before that, I mean, anything to add to what Bruce said in terms of the security map of the northern Afghanistan, in terms of how much change you have witnessed over the past 1 year in terms of Taliban or the other militants' presence in the region, in northern Afghanistan region?
Yeah, the new changes are the increasing presence of Daesh. Like last year when I visited the north, I actually in last October, the presence of Daesh, particularly in this Faryab, Jozjan in Saripul province was a kind of training, and they were busy in training and kind of they are maintaining themselves, just establishing themselves in that kind of prison. But now they are going on offensive. We have reports from Darzab in Jozjan that the Taliban set fire to the shrines, you know, the Sufi shrines. And they set on fire the Sufi shrines, and people in Darzab who were arrested by that Daesh, and then they escaped. They claim that the Daesh has a big presence there. They have established their own prisons, and this was acknowledged. And also, Sayat is becoming, in Saripul province, Sayat in Kohistanat district in Saripul are becoming center of Daesh. There were two significant reports coming from that area that both son of Juma Khan Namangani and Commander Malik, the son of Tahir al-Daesh, are present in Saripul, in Sayat district. One of the Taliban commander who escaped to surrender to Balkh authority, to Mazar-e-Sharif security forces, just 3 days ago, Khan Chirik, I know this commander personally, he himself said that he has seen the son of Tahir al-Daesh in Sayat, which is a little bit behind this Alborz area where he is there. And he claimed that he has around 600 armed men, and he is still not convincing. He said that the Commander Malik told me that he want to have a large force. I want to collect large forces of the Uzbek militant, and then he will start his operation. But they are already starting the killing of two Red Cross worker in Jozjan was something unprecedented. And the Red Cross worker have been traveling to the Taliban area in all over Afghanistan, but they were not touching them. And the Taliban flatly denied this news. But all the government authorities and the local people, they are all saying that this was the work of Qari Hikmat, a well-known IS or Daesh commander in the area.
Mohammed, if I may interject there, it should come as no surprise. The large segment of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan swore allegiance to the Islamic State is 2015, I believe. So the group split, and it's debatable how much joined the Islamic State and how much joined or stayed loyal to al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But certainly, I would expect if they still remain loyal to the Islamic State, and you've had some IMU leaders like Abu Zar, who was the Mufti for the Islamic State, has sort of recanted and said, look, we made a mistake joining. But the reality is that I'm not shocked that there's a number of Uzbeks that previously were members of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan that would be remain loyal to the Islamic State and are operating in northern Afghanistan, and we should expect that.
So what's the status of these days, Jundullah in IMU itself? Are they still active under their own flag, or are they incorporated to one of these groups already non-existent?
It's a little more difficult for me to assess Jundullah, but again, the one segment is loyal to that segment that joined the Islamic State is no longer the IMU. It's flagged under the Islamic State, and the other segment remains active. They released a statement within the past year and said, look, they laid low, but they're still fighting alongside the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and they still call themselves the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan. Jundullah doesn't produce as much propaganda, so it's a little harder to see what they're saying and how they view this. But my understanding is that the bulk of the movement is still fighting alongside the Taliban.
Okay. Bruce, I mean, feel free to jump in here. So when we spoke about these groups and their intentions on one of our last majlis, I believe several months ago, one argument behind their presence in northern Afghanistan was their interest, potential interest in Central Asia. Are you still in this belief?
Well, can I start?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Amin.
Yes, I think the IS, or what is called in Afghanistan as Daesh, is different from the Daesh in Syria and Iraq. In Afghanistan, first of all, we have two kind of Daesh, which is very different from each other. We have Daesh in Nangarhar, which is mostly made up of the Pakistani Taliban, who lost kind of control in their own area, or they were employed by their masters. They were sent to Nangarhar province, and they are in a position with the Taliban. They are fighting the Afghan Taliban. Yeah. And they are completely following a kind of brutal ideological method, which is being followed by Daesh in Iraq and in Syria. But on the other hand, you have Daesh or IS in northern Afghanistan, who are only using the name of Daesh to survive alongside the Taliban and to avoid a kind of international pressure on the Taliban that they are accommodating people from Central Asia or those who are opposing the Central Asian countries. And I think they are just using the name of Daesh. They are not even calling themselves IS or ISIS or Jundala. Now in northern Afghanistan, they are completely calling themselves Daesh. They are stationed in Badakhshan. You know, two districts of Badakhshan are now under the control of Taliban. They are using these two districts, Yamgan and Wardoj. And now and they are stationed on the western flank of the north in Faryab, in Jowzjan, in Saripol province, and they are using the name of Daesh. And they are totally busy in anti-Uzbekistan activities. And they told the villagers when they were in Aqcha that they are freely moving between Uzbekistan and Afghanistan through Tajikistan. They go through Khalaizal district, they infiltrate into this farmland of Tajikistan, and then they turn to Uzbekistan. And once they crossed into Afghanistan, because that area is Uzbek populated, no one can differentiate between an Afghan Uzbek and Uzbekistani Uzbek. The language is the same, the culture is the same, appearing the same, and even the clothes is now the same. And of course, they have their Uzbek supporters and the Afghan side of the border, who can accompany them to their bases in Jowzjan provinces. People have seen such example that a vehicle came, for example, last year to Aqcha, which had the picture of Commander Massoud. But from the vehicle, the Taliban emerged, and there were another Taliban pickup waiting for them. They took that pickup and went toward the Jarsai area of Saipol. Mm-hmm. These kind of activities are going on there.
It's totally mind-blowing. Bruce, jump in. What's your reading of this?
Well, it's certainly a confusing situation. I mean, we've had militants from originally from Central Asia that were in the Pakistani tribal areas, and they've been at times trickling back into Afghanistan, and at times small waves of them have come into Afghanistan. And it seems to be more a chronological kind of thing, where the ones that were coming, you know, say from 2006 and kept coming until about 2014. You know, obviously these people were allied to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and as they made their way into the north, they tended to gravitate toward the Taliban groups that were already present there. It was really when Usman Ghazi said shortly before his death, when he pledged allegiance of the group to Daesh, Islamic State, so-called Islamic State group, and ordered, sent groups, at least two different groups of Uzbeks into Afghanistan, that we see that there's this new wave of IMU fighters that came in and joined. And in one case, at least one of these groups of IMU fighters was sent all the way to Herat, and where they were basically annihilated, certainly beaten on the field of battle by the traditional Taliban group. And these are the ones that kind of spread out across in the area south of the Turkmen border. So, like I said, I've talked to people that talked about these guys that claim that they're Daesh in south of Turkmenistan's border, and the comment that I remember one person saying was these people change names and flags, you know, practically every other day. So one day they're Taliban, and the next day they're Islamic State, and it's hard to say if they're really part of either one of those groups or they're just opportunists that, you know, take advantage of the situation and kind of roll with the way the wind or blow with the way the wind's blowing or something. So, you know, it is confusing, but at least that's my take on it, is that the ones that came earlier prior to 2014 are more likely to be allied with the Taliban. And then after 2014, there's a lot of mixture. Some of them came out and went to join Taliban allied groups, and some of them were sent and with the purpose of, promoting the ideas of the so-called Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how much of the this increasing insecurity in northern Afghanistan can be alluded to these foreign fighters there?
Well, I can say that they are increasing the insecurity. Otherwise, the insecurity is there already because of the large Taliban presence there. And also, not only Taliban, because of the presence of thousands of illegal armed militia. They are adding very terribly to the insecurity of that area. But their presence is giving a kind of boost to the Taliban morals, in a kind of disappointment to the people that saying, that, hey, there are illegal arms group, there are Talibans, now look at these foreign fighters. So their presence in a kind of make the northern Afghanistan like a jungle that everyone comes in
does whatever they
start implementing their own agenda. On the other hand, it increases kind of pressure on the government and the fledgling Afghan forces who are already suffering from different factors to fight illegal armed group, or should they fight the Talibans, or should they fight this new emerging group which has a lot of resources. Khan Chirik, the commander who surrendered with 200 men 3 days ago, he told the Mazar police, the commander who talked to me, he said that Malik Yoldash had a lot of resources, a lot of brand new weapons, very nice clothing, you know, a lot of nice shoes. They are, unlike the other Taliban, they are not using people houses to feed their fighters. You know, in Afghanistan, the Taliban mostly use the forced hospitality of the people. They force people to feed their fighters, or to provide them lunch, dinner, etc. And they go to people guest houses and feed their fighters. But they are not doing this. They are buying everything for themselves, you know, from the market, and they feed their fighters. So the confusion is where this, all this money comes for, the 600 fighters of Malik Yoldash. So this is a kind of disappointing, in a kind of alienating people from the government. Hmm. But hey, where is the government if they are surrounded by different fighters? And in fact, except for Mazar-e-Sharif, which is like, you know, Balkh province in large, which is like kind of paradise, you know, in this case, you know, the whole north, even the Jawzjan, which is the birthplace of General Dostum, or whom province of General Dostum is mostly influenced by these different militant fighters.
Interesting. So what does this mean, this security situation in northern Afghanistan, means to Central Asia, and what are the Central Asian countries doing about this? Let's talk about this aspect shortly after the break. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like the Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the discussion that today on the Majlis we are discussing deteriorating security situation in northern Afghanistan and what does it mean to Central Asia. Joining me in the discussion are Bill Rodju, editor of Long War Journal, Amin Mudakik, a journalist originally from northern Afghanistan and is director of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Pakistan service, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlaq Awazi, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Majlis. So, Bruce, now this is your territory. Tell us, please, when Central Asians looks towards Afghanistan and the type of situation that Amin has just described, what do they see?
Well, obviously, they got to be a little bit worried. You know, I mean, it was only 4 or 5 years ago that was a pretty safe area. And really, they hadn't had to worry about it since the Taliban got chased from power in 2001. And all of a sudden, they can see that they're picking up reports that there's a lot more activity in these regions and a lot more fighting going on in there. And in some cases, of course, there are districts that are right on the border, certainly of Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, where there has been fighting. This would have been at least audible to border guards in Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, if not actually visual, where they could see that there was fighting going on. So they're certainly aware of this stuff. We got the reports from Turkmenistan that bullets, you know, land in some of these villages sometimes. But of course, the nature of the government is they try to cover this up immediately. Certainly Turkmenistan, we know, has gone on a new spending spree for weapons. They've called up their reserves. According to some reports, they got 80% of their armed forces now massed along the Afghan border, just in case. Tajikistan pretty much falls in step with Russia all the time and spreads these alarming reports and uses figures that come from Russian officials, including their representative in Afghanistan, of thousands of militants now that are active, you know, just south of their border. And they make it sound like it's obviously a very dire situation. Now, of course, we haven't seen anyone really cross the border since the two Turkmen incidents in 2014. These governments have got to be a little bit worried. They would remember how it was when they had the Taliban as neighbors, and certainly the months that led up to the Taliban actually taking the territory on their border, where in the Tajik and Uzbek case, there was almost panic in 1998, 1999 that these militants had come to their border. So it's definitely a matter of concern for them. It plays into Russia's hands, of course, obviously, where the Russian officials never hesitate to remind them that this is a serious situation and their best protection is to ally themselves in the Russian-led Collective Security Treaty Organization, mm-hmm. which Tajikistan is a member of, but which Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan are not. So, you know, there's a lot of concern, and they've, for the last couple of years, they've been doing everything they can to prop up their defenses and try to make sure that they don't get drawn in.
Tell us a little bit more about that, what they are doing, besides being just concerned.
Well, I mean, like I said, Turkmenistan has, spent a lot of money on new weaponry and called up the reserves. It's not a very easy country to get information out of, but such information as we can get indicates that they have deployed a large amount of forces up there and given them all these new weapons, and they're buying weapons from the Chinese. We know the Russian defense minister made a visit there in June 2016, which doesn't seem to be something that Turkmenistan requested. It was more of the Kremlin just forced the Turkmen to accept him to come, and he laid out the case that the security situation along the Turkmen-Afghan border is not good and that they are going to need some help, and Turkmenistan is trying to keep them at arm's length for now, but it's pretty clear that Russia has concerns. Kazakh presidents mentioned that too. Tajikistan, you know, they've been working with Russia to, and Amin knows more about this three-layer defense than I do, but they've been working with Russia for several years now to get their three layers of defense there so that they don't have to worry too much. Uzbekistan is the exception, and Amin already mentioned that Balkh is itself an exception. That's the only northern Afghan province that borders Uzbekistan. So it's been relatively quiet in Balkh, and the Uzbek border with Afghanistan is not very long, 150, 160 kilometers. So they have their forces massed there for a long, long time, and it would be difficult for anybody to come across just because it's not a very long border and there's such a heavy military presence on the northern side of the Amudarya that I couldn't imagine them getting through. But you know, they're doing what they can. They all seem to feed into the doomsday scenario, and they're preparing for that. And we just saw, of course, Tajikistan and Russia just held another round of military exercises that reportedly involved 50,000 military and support personnel. Only 2,000 of them were Russians, but it's these kind of things that show you that they really are taking this seriously in Central Asia, and it is a concern.
Talking about Central Asians, the cross-border contacts with groups in Afghanistan become topic of the day. Let's start with the latest claim by Ismail Khan, on which Bruce, you earlier alluded to. So Ismail Khan is one of the prominent figure in Western Afghanistan. He said something very strange involving Turkmenistan's activities with the Taliban, though it's not the first claim of this nature, but it was significant considering Ismail Khan's position as a national figure. I mean, what were you able to find out more on that claim by Ismail Khan?
Well, to say that Turkmenistan is ideologically supporting the Taliban, it is out of questions.
Right.
They are kind of pursuing two different ideologies, two different type of thinking of government. But Turkmenistan has a kind of history in dealing with the extremist group in dealing with the Taliban, just to save and protect their own boundary through dealing. Mm-hmm. And we know this from the time of Taliban. I myself was a member of a delegation to Herat province. I've seen the Turkmen consulate fully functioning during the Taliban. And the Turkmen consul, you know, clearly told this delegation their presence does not mean that they like Taliban, but their presence means that they want to protect their own national interest by easiest way. You know, this was his expression. And I said that they are helping the Taliban government, and they are having this economic deals with them, and they are participating in some project. So the question from that delegation was that, is this mean that you are supporting militancy or extremism? Because he said that, as I said before, if we can achieve our goal by easiest way, we will do that. So probably Turkmenistan is following the same strategy, just to keep the Taliban happy and not to annoy them. There are even reports that last year some of the members of the National Assembly were complaining in Faryab, in Jawzjan, were complaining that some of the Taliban injured people were also taken to Turkmenistan and they were treated there. So these kind of things are there, you know, but all kind of conspiracy theory, it's very difficult to establish the fact. But the history is there, the experience is there that Turkmenistan want to do this just to protect their borders, you know, by keeping the Taliban and militant happy.
Just as a disclaimer, the Turkmenistan's foreign ministry, I believe, refuted the Ismail Khan's comment on this subject. Bill, recently U.S. general in Afghanistan has accused Russia of supplying the Taliban. What do you mean?
Yeah, so we haven't seen any specific claims, but I'm skeptical that this is happening at a large enough scale to actually make a difference to the Taliban. But what I think is happening here is that the Russians are reading the tea leaves in Afghanistan, and they've determined that the U.S. and NATO is losing this war and that the Taliban are going to have a presence. One of the things the Russians seem to be concerned about in their statements is the Islamic State. I think this is very short-sighted if you're the Russians, because the Taliban is allied with numerous jihadist groups, including Al-Qaeda, which has a far more significant presence in when you put together Afghanistan and Pakistan, as well as the satellite jihadist groups that are cooperating with the Taliban. These groups have been a threat to the Russians in the form of the Islamic Caucasus Emirates, in which has conducted numerous attacks. Now, largely that's been taken over by the Islamic State, but the group is still persistent. So the Russia has a very real enemy there. But I think what they're trying to do is basically bribe the Taliban in certain areas to keep the Islamic State at bay. I would like to see more specifics from the U.S. commanders as to what the nature of that support. You know, we've seen reports that the Iranians have been funding and providing weapons to the Taliban. I think those have largely panned out. And I suspect that the claims, look, a U.S. commander isn't going to make that claim about Russia without something to back it up. The question becomes is how significant is that support? And the other question is why are they doing that? And again, my guess is that the Russians really want to keep the Islamic State at bay, and they view the Taliban as an acceptable proxy to make that happen. It's short-sighted, it's stupid, frankly, but this is the way things seem to play out in this part of the world.
What do you know about the Russian engagement with the Taliban? Obviously, this is more than just a discussion, I believe. You have had already several meetings took place in Moscow, top Russian leaders talking about, you know, Taliban being part of the discussion. You know, to say the least, Russia is trying to legitimize the group. What's your take?
Well, I think one thing is now certain, that Russia entered the field, you know, because the deputy of general staff of the Russian command, he visited Waziristan, which is unusual.
Yeah, that's
another military commander of the U.S. Of the Russian Federation to visit that particular part of the country, which is the main base of the Haqqani group. And even I think in recent history, U.S. military people did not visit that area, except for the two U.S. congressmen who were there last year. that indicate that Russia is now fully engaged, you know, in that area. Intelligence information, we don't have it. This is the work of intelligence. Of course, when General Nicholson is complaining about the Russian support to the Taliban, he must have seen something. But we journalists always use our own sources, which are sometimes good and sometimes reliable, sometimes not. I have two information which support this. One is the breakaway faction of Taliban, which is called Fida-e Mahaz. You know, this breakaway faction, although they break tie from the main faction, but they still have friends in contact.
Yeah.
He sent the Fida-e Mahaz sent an email in December last year to the media saying that, I quote, in the city of Zahedan of Iran, Iran established a big center which is led by an Iranian general, General Tahiri, which is called Al-Ansar Center. And that center is a meeting place between Russian, Iranian, and the Taliban group, which they call it Qatari militia. And according to this email, and they are regularly coming to this center. The former Taliban leader, Mansour, was also one of the attendants of the center. They said he came to meet the Iranian and Russian in this center, in Zahedan, in this Ansar center, where he was killed upon his return to Pakistan. The second piece of information, which is very interesting, and we recently have, is that the Taliban have a kind of spokesman within the who is living in Kabul. He regularly appears in the TV debate and discussion in support of the Taliban. He, on one occasion, he was arrested by the Afghan intelligence for being too pro-Taliban. This person wrote in his Facebook on March 28 and said that Mullah Jalil, the former secretary of Mullah Omar and the deputy foreign minister, traveled to Moscow recently through the facilitation of Pakistan and returned to Pakistan. Although Mullah Jalil rejected the claim, but this kind of information are there in addition to the official U.S. claims. Mm.
Yeah, there is no way to independently verify these reports or content of the letter, as I mean you just said. But the fact is, Iran's engagement with the Taliban are also something increasingly being discussed on the media. With this, we have to unfortunately end the discussion. But the last point, so Bruce, if Russia is not supplying anything to Taliban, but its engagement with the Taliban is also not limited only with the discussion. So what it is trying to gain from this?
Well, there's a lot of theories here. I suppose the most common one is that Russia does not view the Taliban as much of a threat to Central Asia and by extension to Russia as it does Daesh, the so-called Islamic State group, because to date, the Taliban has been more of just an Afghan movement. That's as far as we can ever tell, that's their stated goal. Al-Qaeda is different, but Taliban just want control of Afghanistan, whereas the Islamic State is very transnational, and they want to spread their message to as many places as possible. And I think that's where at least the theory is that Russia views the Taliban as being a threat solely to Afghanistan and not really presenting much of a threat beyond Afghanistan's border, whereas the Islamic State is a totally different kind of a group. And given the choice between the two, they would take the Taliban, although as many people have pointed out, and as we've heard even on this program, if you're going to deal with the Taliban, then they have a lot of other allies who are transnational terrorist organizations. So,
Just a quick brief point, Bruce, if you could. So what does this increasing Russian activity on Taliban means to Central Asia?
Well, it's going to, you know, the Central Asians are seen as part of the former Soviet Union, and it's going to have an effect on the way that people south of the border look at the Central Asian governments. They're going to think that Russia is that the Central Asians are either participating with them or helping them or being forced to help Russia or something. But it's going to really erode any kind of independent credibility that the Central Asians have in dealing with anybody south of their borders.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Also, big thanks, Bill Ruggio, editor of Long War Journal, and Amin Mudakkik, head of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Pakistan service called Radio Mashal, for your insightful comments, time, and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. A pleasure.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, your host in Washington, D.C. Until next week. Bye-bye.